This is the Literary License Podcast with your hosts, Vicky Ray, John Wilson, and Keith Shorgo, discussing book to screen and everything in between, coming at you from the UK and USA.
They keep it real.
I heard something.
Get near the top.
Fellas, here's your story. North Pole, November 3rd. Ned Scott reporting. One of the world's greatest battles was fought and won today by the human race. Here at the top of the world, a handful of American soldiers and civilians met the first invasion from another planet.
Is there any blood in there?
No.
Its blood has been drained.
Everything falls right into line. What could be more natural for a being of its kind than seeking out the only open earth within miles? It came here for refuge, heard us, and ran. It's been here, it'll come back again.
We'd better tell Captain
Pennington. I don't agree with you, Doctor. I think it far better if science rather than
Doctor,
the army.
Doctor, are you sure this is the best thing?
I'm sure we can communicate with it. We must. It's wiser than we are. It's our only chance to talk to it, to learn so many things.
Okay, Karen, it's right.
Surely you can understand that, Stern.
Hello, welcome to Literary License Podcast. And today we're discussing Who Goes There, which was a short novella written by John W. Campbell and was turned into the classic film directed by Howard Hawks. Or, depending on who you speak to, Charles Nyby. Well,
Christian Nyby.
What we'll do is we'll have to actually, we'll discuss that later on when we get to the film part of it. And today we have with us Stephen L. Kent. Say hello, Stephen.
Hi.
And Nicholas Kaufman.
Hello, nice to be here.
And they are the authors of 100 Fathoms Below, which is able to be purchased now through Amazon. Highly suggest it. Was one of my favorite books that was actually mentioned in our newsletter, if you remember our newsletter, and it's also on our webpage under our favorite books. So before we go any further, let's talk about what we've been up to. So Stephen, what have you been up to?
Well, you know, I also write about video games a bit. So I recently was contracted by Random House to do I did a book back in 2000 called The Ultimate History of Video Games. Not a title I chose, by the way. but they've contracted me to do a second volume of it. So I'm running around talking to people from the video game world. Everybody from Axl Rose, from Guns N' Roses, to Shigeru Miyamoto.
I'm a huge gamer, so I'm going to look out for that one. So,
okay. What's your favorite game?
At the moment, I'm really into Assassin's Creed Odyssey. But before that, I really loved the Fallout games, and I really liked, I really liked Tomb Raider when it first came out, Resident Evil, of course. But I liked Mass Effect, the first three games of it. I think that Bethesda does a really good job with their games and gets you fully immersed. I tend to go for more games that have a really good storyline than one that has, it's just kill. Kill. So I go for really strong storylines and one I can get like emotionally in depth with. So I tend to go for those.
Very good.
And what about yourself, Nicholas? What have you been up to?
I've been working on some short stories, two of which were recently published in a UK magazine called Black Static. One of which was recently published. The other one will be published, I think, in January. And I've been teaching writing online with Lit Reactor. I've been teaching a course called Runaway Prose, which was also, like Steve was mentioning, not a title I chose, but is all about writing fast-paced novels. This is really interesting and brand new in my life. I have begun work as a background actor in television and movie productions here in New York.
Ooh, you're an extra.
I am an extra. Yeah. Yes, I am. I've been doing it since for a couple of months now, and it's been really interesting work. I've met some really interesting people, which I don't mean that. I don't mean that as a euphemism. I do mean they were actually very interesting. And it's been great, and it's a wonderful source of making a little bit of extra money too, because as I'm sure you know, being a writer is not the glamorous lifestyle it is often portrayed as in films and television. So this has been a good source of extra income.
Oh, excellent. Well, myself, I've just been working my 9-to-5, and I've been catching up on my television. I finished the Sabrina television show on Netflix, which is excellent. I highly recommend it. And I finished The Haunting of Hill House, which I was highly disappointed, but I think that if you're going to call yourself The Haunting of Hill House, you've got some pretty big boots to fill. And unfortunately, I'm a really big fan of Shirley Jackson's, and I'm a very big fan of the original Haunting. So I felt a bit cheated and ripped off for the simple fact. I think they just used the name and decided to call some character names, and that was as far as they went. And I think, as I stated in our podcast before, I found who directed it. They directed The House of Hill House, and it just seemed like it was more, it didn't really have a lot of scope. I think the director just works on a lot of TV, not a lot of films, so it didn't have a lot of scope. So the house looked basically like a bedsit in a huge house. So I don't know. I mean, it didn't really hold it for me, but I know that a lot of people like it, and they do care for it, so... But.
I'm a big fan of the novel and of The Haunting, the 1963 film, I think. Mm-hmm. But I also actually did enjoy the Netflix miniseries. It's definitely its own story.
Yeah.
But I thought the characters were amazing, and I loved the dynamics of the family, and I think that's what carried me through. I think the ending was disappointing, but ultimately I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that if they didn't call it The Haunting of Hill House, I think they called it something else. I think that I would probably go on it with no expectations and enjoyed it. Because I did like the simple way that they carried down what happens after the haunting and the family goes back to normality. And I quite like that aspect of it. But when it got to like the actual hauntings and stuff like this, I found it like, okay, you know. Probably because I was looking forward to like the crane story and the building of the Hill House. And I was kind of like...
Right, when I heard that the family was the Cranes, I thought it was actually going to be a prequel. Mm. Which it was not, but yeah, I mean, I have some questions too. I don't understand why there was a ghost of a clock repairman in the house, for instance. Did this guy just keel over one day when he was repairing the clock? I have questions, but ultimately I enjoyed it.
I think we're in the age of The Conjuring, where I think you can just take anything and do whatever you want to and have all these stupid things like, wait a minute, no one will ever know why the nun was in The Conjuring, because, you know, if you ever see anything about the Enfield poltergeist, there's no nun in that story, or there's no Annabelle in the first Conjuring, you know what I mean? And if you look at the original Annabelle, I mean, it's a Raggedy Ann doll. So I guess...
I think they didn't have the right... to the name Raggedy Ann, so they had to call it Annabelle.
Well, those toy companies are big corporations, so.
Could be worse, could be Chucky.
Well, they're redoing Chucky too, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird that they're going to redo it, because with the new franchise installments of it, they've done a really good job. They went a bit silly with Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky. And then they came back with The Curse of Chucky, and they've gone a bit more darker now. And it actually seems to be finding its grounding again. So it's kind of weird that they would want to, you know, reboot a series that's doing okay with as far as the sequels go.
But, I think they want to attract a new audience rather than people who have seen all the sequels. It's all about money. I mean, you know this.
And Halloween, now that has become a big blockbuster, you know, which... You know, it's rewritten its storyline yet again, so it's doing very, you know, it's doing very well. So,
I think this is what the third or fourth timeline for the Halloween movies.
Well, I mean, it's pretty bad when your storyline and timelines are more messed up than Friday the 13th. So, So what we're going to do now is we're going to the forming the plot part of our show. We're going to discuss Who Goes There, which was written in 1938 for Astounding Science Fiction, and it was written by John W. Campbell. What's the interesting thing about Who Goes There is that it has actually inspired a lot of writers, and it also has inspired three films. The film that we'll be discussing later on, The Thing from Another World, and of course, John Carpenter's 1982 cult classic, The Thing, and also the prequel to The Thing, which wasn't so much a cult classic as it seemed to be a little bit of a failure as far as fans are concerned.
And there's another adaption too to film that I can talk about later. It's sort of a very, very loose adaption, but is supposed to be based on Who Goes There.
Now, another good thing about the Who Goes There is also inspired a lot of comics. In 1976, there was Starstream did a comic series, and of course, Dark Horse Comics did one in 1991. There's been a radio drama done by the BBC, and there's also been a board game. One interesting thing is that I think, since we were discussing computer games earlier, PlayStation 3 did the Think computer game, which was quite interesting. I remember playing it. I quite enjoyed it. Sort of thing. It's one of those survival horror kind of games. It kind of went to that kind of trope.
Yeah.
And Who Goes There has become a huge cultural impact even today. So, Nicholas, what did you think of the book Who Goes There?
I enjoyed it very much. I have to admit, I had to keep reminding myself it was written in 1938 and writing styles were different back then. But I think the ideas behind it are spectacular, and there's a very good reason why it's such a classic story. I did pick up on one very strange thing, no pun intended, which is that John W. Campbell has a sort of a real love of describing his characters in terms of metal. So they describe MacReady as this sort of as bronze, right? This 6'4" bronze god of a man, right? And then Norris is described as a man of steel compared to MacReady's bronze. Conant, the cosmic ray specialist, is referred to as Iron Man Conant by Commander Gary. And there's even a Dr. Copper. So I wonder if there was a theme here that he was going for. I'm not sure what. Oh, I see my cat has made an appearance behind me on the screen. I'm not sure why he seems so interested in describing everyone as metal when it is such an organic, when the story is so much about organics. But it just struck me as an interesting theme.
He might have used other analogies, but he was getting a little rusty.
Oh.
I mean, what did you find? What's your initial reactions to it, Stephen?
Well, first, I've got to preface by saying when I was a teenager, my father, who was really into science fiction, told me that he was more moved by the death of John W. Campbell than he was by the death of John F. Kennedy. So, you know, I was really interested to read it. And analog, when I was growing up, was a big thing in our house. When I did read it, this is probably my third or fourth reading of it. I think the first 5 or 10 pages are very stilted. There's very telegraphed dialogue. But once the story gets going, it really is ahead of its time in quite a few ways. I thought Carpenter was much more accurate to it than Hawks, obviously.
Yeah. I found that... Well, it was one of those kind of books that I had to kind of go back and kind of reread it a couple of times. Not the whole, not the whole book itself, but some passages, because I found that there was a bit of a stilted writing style about it. And it was kind of hard. It's because there's not like strong characterizations beyond the, the metal references to the characters, but there's not a lot of strong characterization. So I was kind of getting messed up about who was locked up where and what exactly their job was.
There's not a lot of description of the characters. They are really just names and jobs.
Yeah. Kurt Russell did great favors to that when he was working with Carpenter.
Yeah, when I think of MacReady, I think of Kurt Russell, absolutely.
Yeah. And Keith David.
Oh yeah, the original thing, I mean, had a great cast, but yeah, I mean, it was interesting about, you know, the way that the characters reacted to each other. I mean, I know that there was a lot of, you know, not a lot of privacy and that sort of thing. And the story, it's kind of bizarre that the story starts off with that they've already got the creature back.
Yes.
You know, there's no expedition out to get the creature. So it's almost like a one-act play, really. It's like a, you know, sort of thing, where it's basically everything takes place and it all takes place on one set, really, which is quite interesting considering that. It would have been quite interesting about exactly why they went out there. And I know that there was a magnetic charge that they said that they found that, but it didn't really give a lot of reasons why that it actually popped out, or why did it pop up on their perspective, or why they felt they needed to go out and explore to find out what this thing was.
Yeah. I think in the long run, having it, go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was just saying, and they go to all the trouble they did to dig it out of the ice as deep as they have to go. Mm. Yeah.
I do think in the long run, having it set entirely in the base, where we don't get to see their expedition outside, works thematically, because there's that sense of claustrophobia to it. There's that sense of we're trapped in here with it, and none of us knows who they are. Like the paranoia comes through really well in this. There's a great scene where, you know, with Blair, who suspects everyone to the point of refusing to allow anyone to cook for him, and who would kill all of them, human or not, just to be sure. And then there's that great moment of terror when it's discovered that the cows from whom everyone has been drinking milk are imitations. and that sort of the ending where the reader, if not the characters, are left wondering, was that albatross really an albatross that we saw fly overhead, or has the thing escaped? It's so marvelous. And I think like Steve said, it's so ahead of its time in dealing with these ideas.
As I was speaking to Stephen earlier, I thought it was quite bizarre that the actual story was written in 1938, because whilst reading it, if it was done in the mid-50s to late-50s, it feels like a McCarthy story. You know, the whole thing about turning on each other and the Red Scare of the communism that was going on at that time. And it kind of does foreshadow all that with what would happen later on in American history.
Well, and it was echoed by an invasion of the body snatchers, which was McCarthy era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I felt the short story, it moves at a good pace, and luckily it's short. I think that if it was any longer, there's a bit of a drone to the whole proceedings, the way it's written. It kind of drones onwards. It just drones.
It is very dry, yes.
And I found that, you know, as I said before, some of the relationships are not very, very clear. And I did walk away from the reading it, not having a really strong sense of any one particular character in my mind, outside of the ones that did remind me of the film characters, but not within the setting of the story.
So it's really a story or a novella you read for the situation and not for much else.
Yeah. But I did think it did lend itself to that whole tone of not knowing who anybody is. And I quite like that side of it, not knowing exactly who everyone is. And, you know, if someone came into your life and they were imitating themselves, would you be able to find out that they're an imitation, or would you be able to tell that they're the real thing? And I quite like that that theme that it did explore within the short story.
Especially this idea that it is telepathic, and so therefore would know everything about the person that it's imitating, right down to, you know, what they would want to do in a situation, or how they would talk, or stuff like that. I'm not sure that Carpenter's thing went that far. I don't know if his thing was telepathic or just mimicking. But here it's really a scary idea. And it's a little bit like Blade Runner when you think about it, right? Because you wouldn't know if you were a replicant in Blade Runner, because you've been given false memories. So it's certainly possible you could be the thing and not entirely know that, because your telepathy has given you this other person's life as memories and way of thinking. It's an interesting idea.
Well, it's one that seems to be explored in the television series Westworld now, doesn't it?
Yes. You
know, who's real, who isn't, and who's a replica, who's not a replica, sort of thing. Well, I think even American Horror Story did it with this spoiler alert, but if you do watch American Horror Story, Kathy Bates episode, we're like the fifth one in, but it's come that she is a android. And the evil guy in it
has been, so over the top.
But the funny thing is that the evil guy in it, who wanted her, who made it into, you know, his mother figure, has given her false memories. So basically, you know, like her Halloween memory is her being Rosie the Robot and things like this.
Right.
Since, so, you know, so they kind of like done that thing. It's kind of like there is a tongue in cheekness to it, like American Horror Story tends to do. But yeah, I mean, I guess you could, you know, with androids, you know, they, you know, the way technology is going, it might be a thing of the future, you know. Well, I know as far as the sex industry, it seems to be a thing of the future, but I'm not sure about what it's going to be like in an everyday sort of life.
I think the sex industry is almost always the forerunner of any new technology, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
What I think he deserves, Campbell deserves credit for, there are sayings that we hear, and we hear them every day, so we don't think about the connotations, maybe the ambience, or even cadence that they have. Who goes there is, when you stop to think about it, there is a real fear behind it. In boxing, the last thing the referee always tells you is protect yourself at all times. When you take it out of context and think about what it's saying, there's a lot of power to that, the title, Who Goes There?
I found also that I think the science behind it was very well done. I mean, I found it, as you said before, it was kind of dry and it just take a while for the story to get onwards because it's caught up in the science. But it did feel like, I work in psychiatry and that's what I do for a full-time job. And I found that as far as some of the medical science in it, it just seemed very plausible the way he acted, you know, the way that he did have it. It did make sense within the story. You know, it did feel like a textbook, as we stated before, but it did seem to be able to work, that this could be real. And I thought that was quite impressive because a lot of science fiction has a difficult time getting the science part of it right sometimes. And sometimes, you know, especially with age goes on, that when science moves on, and sometimes what you'll find in some of these old science fiction stories is that the science is way off base.
And well, there's two real schools in science fiction. You have the Ray Bradbury school, where he actually attacks people who are too wrapped up in the science. And then you have the hard science fiction. What's the guy from Nova? Charles Sagan. Mm-hmm. You know, where what they do is they find an anomaly in science and write an entire book about it. And so the thing that's interesting about Campbell, he did both sides of that. He definitely did things where he ran away from science and just had fun with a fantasy story, but he could also turn around and go completely hard science by 1930s or 40s or 50s standard, and build a whole story around that as well. He was, in that way, you would have to say he was ambidextrous.
I do wonder, it's an actual question. Did that exist? Did they talk a lot about the human immune rabbit and then the immune dogs in the story? Was that actual science back then, where they could inject human blood into an animal if it had been treated properly already, to make these kinds of tests?
Well, I know as far as in lab experiments today, they do put a bit of human blood into serums and stuff like that to test drugs and stuff into rats and to rabbits. Now, whether, you know, I mean, we're all mammals, so I guess it would be plausible. I mean, you know, we all share, you know, that's one good thing about all mammals. They all kind of share the same, they share the same blood types. But I'm not sure if you do a blood transfusion, you know, that's something else entirely. So
it did put me in mind of the old pregnancy tests with the rabbit test, right? But that was as close as I knew to real science for that.
Well, but you know, something you and I have in common here, Nick, is with vampires. Vampire bats can walk around, can fly around for years with rabies, and it never impacts them. They're kind of a typhoid Mary in that way.
Right.
Yeah, that's true, actually. And they're like carriers and not subject. I guess you get that with some communicable diseases. You do have humans around who are walking around who can have a disease that can be communicable to other people, but they never actually suffered the signs or symptoms themselves, and they're actually, they'll never get sick from it, but they can cause others to be sick.
That was Mary Mallon, the woman who known as Typhoid Mary. She was going around America. The only thing she was employable as was a cook, but she had typhoid that wasn't infecting her. It just infected thousands of people she cooked for.
And then she finally passed away here in New York City. That's our claim to fame here.
Typhoid Mary passed away in New York City. God, that makes the mind boggle, actually, the way science and nature does work. What did you think about the end, the way that he ends the short story? Did you like his ending, or?
Yeah, I like it when you can have an ending as something Nick's quite good at, frankly, where you walk away thinking it's not really ended, has it? You know, or has it? I hope it's over. I don't want to go through it again, but darn, it's open. The door is still open.
The characters do seem pretty sure that they've defeated the thing once and for all. But there, as I mentioned before, there is that question of the albatross that they see flying away. As Steve mentions, I think it's a really good kind of ending, you know, where you're not entirely sure.
If I could throw something at you, after reading this, there are some elements of your novel, 100 Fathoms Below, right?
I can
never remember if it's 100 Fathoms or 100 Fathoms Below. So 100 Fathoms Below. But you kind of do have that, you do have the whole paranoia within your story as well. Which I thought, talking from your book personally, I thought that's what really made the story work. And one thing I said there that your story did that this didn't do for me is that your characters are a lot stronger. Actually, people could identify with your characters a lot more. And I think, you know, I think the problem with Who Goes There as far as characters are concerned, not the actual story itself, but not the plot, but the stories, is that for me, I felt that if we had a bit of foreshadowing with the characters and we were kind of like dropped in the middle of the situation, and it's almost like being dropped into the middle of a party and everyone knows each other and you're the odd person out and you don't know anybody. And so you're just trying to pick up, you know, you're trying to catch up with what the conversation's going. And that's what I found with Who Goes There a little bit, is that you're kind of dropped into, the reader's dropped into a situation and it's up to them to try to catch up with what the hell is going on with the character relationships, how they get on with each other, and exactly who these people are.
It is hard for the reader to identify strange behavior in characters where we've never actually seen them behave normally yet, you know, so it's hard for... you know, the characters talk about, you know, looking for strange behavior in each other, but the reader can't find that. I don't know if this is by choice on his part or just the way it worked out, but the reader has no idea what these people are normally like, so we have no idea if their behavior is strange or not. I think you're right in that it is a bit of a shortcoming. But I guess it does, on the other hand, it does keep the mystery going too.
I mean, I'm not very much versed in 1930s literature, but I'm kind of wondering, did this actually fit the way that writers are writing in the 30s? I read a lot of 1950s stuff, you know, Vertigo, Marnie. I've also read The Bad Seed and other books that were written in that era in the 1950s. But 1930s, I'm not too familiar with 1930s writers.
So you have W. Somerset Maugham and Edgar Wallace. Those guys were boiling pots left and right. You had Ernest Hemingway. You had towards the end of his career, F. Scott Fitzgerald was there. You had some wonderful writers who did beautiful character development and phenomenal prose. But you didn't have them so much in the genre fiction, the just open fiction. You know, I mean, we really benefited from Shirley Jackson and later Richard Matheson and some of the greats, you know, leading up to Stephen King and Peter Straub, you know, who really, they set a bar so that you couldn't just say, well, I'm just writing for genre after that. These are people who, whatever genre they got in or put in the mainstream, were as good as everybody around them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with what you said about Hemingway and Somerset Maugham, but I said before, but I'm not exactly versed in those. It's kind of weird, but a lot of what I tend to read is everything from 1950s onwards, or it will be kind of 19, the Victorian stuff, the 1800s sort of thing. So, but for some reason, I've always tend to miss out on that. Those three decades of writing between 1900, well, actually 5 decades between 1900s and 1950s. And for some reason, I don't have a lot of education as far as that goes. I mean, I did, of course, read Hemingway in school, and the ones that you have to read in school. But I've actually never actually taken up the mantle in pleasure reading from that point forward. So, but. I have to sit there and say, after reading this, I am interesting. I had bought the whole short story collection by him, and I am going to go dive down into that and see how I find the other stuff. Because he did pique my interest. And I did refer to
anything else by him. I've never read his other work, so I don't know if this is his regular style or not. But I do know that there was recent news that a longer version of the story was found amongst his papers, a novel-length version. Called Frozen Hell. That apparently he edited down to write, to make this novella-length story. So it's certainly possible that in the novel-length version, all of the shortcomings that we're seeing in terms of characterization or description are rectified because he had more room to play.
I'm glad he changed the title.
Yeah.
Makes it sound real pulpy, doesn't it? Frozen.
Well, it's like a really bad Dairy Queen.
I mean, I guess with John W. Campbell, I mean, I guess the good thing is that I think his name will actually live on because, I mean, this is considered one of the best short stories in science fiction in 1973. It was called the finest science fiction novella ever written by the Science Fiction Writers of America. But I also think with John W. Campbell is that, from my understanding, is because of the magazine that he used to edit, Astounding Tales, I imagine for a whole generation that this must have been, a bit like, how a generation is to Twilight Zone or Outer Limits or to, the horror comics of the 50s. He must have been like a huge folk hero to a whole generation of science fiction readers in the 1930s, 40s.
One of his discoveries was Del Rey, a name we all know from the Del Rey Publishing House. And actually, I got to cheat because I read it from this book here, this collection by Del Rey of John W. Campbell's works. And, he talks about how Asimov was a discovery by Campbell and Bova and the names, wow. We cling to as the new god of science fiction, a lot more discovery.
I mean, I was looking at some of his, his magazine covers, or his, the amazing stories. And I have to sit there and say, if I was a kid at that time, I would have definitely been buying those. I would have definitely been like totally invested in that, the astounding stories.
Yeah.
So overall, what's your overall feel after reading of Who Goes There? Would you recommend it?
I would only recommend it in a classroom setting. I think it's got a lot of value in a creative writing class to discuss what went right, what went wrong, why it was revolutionary, what incredible gambles he took, which ones paid off and which ones didn't. Mm.
And what about yourself, Nick? What are your final thoughts?
I'm going to ditto that. I would recommend it because of its historical importance as source material for two great films, or depending. But I would not necessarily recommend the story as you have to read this because it's going to knock your socks off. But again, I think the ideas are so big and still pretty powerful. So yeah, I would recommend it, but I think I would give lots of caveats.
And myself, I would recommend it. But for me, it actually opened up another world for me, which I found was quite good. There's not a lot of things that actually do that, because I'm becoming quite jaded the older I get. And I found that it actually has opened up like the writings of John W. Campbell. And I've actually said before, I've actually purchased a bunch of his short stories to get into and start diving further into his concept of writing. So I would actually recommend it. I think that if you're a fan of The Thing or The Thing from Another World, or you're looking for science fiction that has a ring of scientific truth to it, and it's something you can really dive into, I think, you know, who goes there, you can't really go wrong with it.
You'll never look at cows the same way again.
Yeah. Well, we probably are until today using synthetic cows for our milk anyway, the way life's going.
right.
So, well, what we're going to do is we're going to cut to a commercial break, and then we're going to come back and discuss The Thing from Another Planet, directed by Howard Hawks. Or it was directed by Christian Nyby, which we'll get into later. So please stay tuned and listen to a message from our sponsor.
Amazon is here to make your life easier. By just the tap of a button, you can turn the camera on your phone to your own personal shopping list. Introducing Flow. Just tap the camera icon onto the search bar and you can find whatever it is you're looking for right on Amazon. Faster than scanning a barcode and typing the name of your item into the search engine. Besides, searching with words is so 2012. Save time and money. Amazon, where shopping meets effortless.
That whistle alive, sir. I saw it. I shot it. I hit it. I know it. Nothing happened. It just kept coming at me, making a noise like a cat mewing. Captain, it was awful. You could have seen those hands and those eyes. Captain, you've got to do something about it. You've got...
Is it human or inhuman? Earthly or unearthly? Baffling questions, astounding questions that not even the world's greatest scientific minds can answer.
Gentlemen, do you realize what we've found? A being from another world as different from us as one pole from the other. If we can only communicate with it.
See? What happened, Doctor?
In the greenhouse, I was working. I couldn't see. Then a blast of cold air, and I heard Olsen scream.
Come here. Get in the corner. Now hold this in front of you. Stay by the light switch.
1.9. Needles hit the top.
When you're heading for a great night out, if you saw a bus stop, would you pee against it? Would you still be grinning as it trickled down your leg? Would you smash a window just because it's there? Would you run across a busy street, then lie down in the middle? Would you shove a mate into the road just to get a laugh? Would you punch a stranger in the face for the way they're looking at you? Would you drink a pint of urine to prove that you're a man? Would you? You wouldn't start a night like this, so why end it that way? Alcohol. Know your limits.
Hello?
What's your favorite scary movie?
I have a bunch of favorite movies. I watch them all on Shudder.com for only $4.99 a month.
That's a scary low price.
But if I had to pick a favorite, it'd probably be Scream.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the only streaming service that lets me watch hundreds of horror movies on demand.
I'll be right back.
Hello? Hello? Hello, are you gonna subscribe? Hello?
Go to Shudder.com to subscribe, if you dare.
Hello, welcome back. Now we're going to be discussing the Thing from Another Planet, which was directed by Christian Nyby. Though some people say it might have been directed by Howard Hawks. It came out in 1951, and it was an American black and white science fiction horror film. And another thing that's quite interesting is when we get into the discussion about this, is that a lot of the, half of the cast members that are making this film said that Christian Nyby directed all of it, though Howard Hawks might have directed one or two scenes, while the other half says the complete opposite. So it's one of those big mysteries that we'll probably never know the real history to, and I'm not sure how much of it's actually folklore or actually based on truth now. So do you have, either one of you have anything about the making of The Thing from Another World?
Yeah, well, I don't know if this is technically about the making of it, but whatever they did worked, in my opinion. Because I feel like this movie really rises above its B monster movie trappings, thanks to the influence, I think, of Howard Hawks and screenwriter Charles Lederer, who had worked together previously on His Girl Friday. And together, I think they let films dialogue an almost screwball attitude that makes the film actually rather charming to watch, which is, you know, there were a lot of 1950s science fiction horror movies that were really just sort of lurid and overwrought, but the character work and the dialogue that they brought to this makes it something special. Makes it, I think, more than the sum of its parts.
And what about yourself, Stephen? Anything to add about the making of the film itself?
I confess complete ignorance when it comes to the making of that movie. I have seen the movie.
Okay, well, we'll do. I don't have a lot about the making of it. I know that everyone that was. The interesting thing is everyone that they cast in this film has gone on to actually pretty decent careers afterwards. They've done a lot of, you know, Twilight Zones, Outer Limits, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Kojak, even up until the 70s. They've all except for the main female actress, Margaret Sheridan, which the reason
and
why...
She was great.
The reason why she was actually giving...
Marshall Matt Dillon, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Sure, but, Gunsmoke, yeah.
But Margaret Sheridan, the only reason why her career did not further is that she was offered a role in Red River with John Wayne. And mm-hmm. What happened was is that she got pregnant and didn't take it. And then after she had the baby, apparently to what you'll read on various formats on the internet, which it is the internet, it's not a Bible of truth, so there could be a bit of falsity to this. But apparently after she had the birth of her child, that she kind of went slightly... neurotic after that, and that she was unable to be cast in anything because they found her difficult to cast. So but they said that if she did take the role in Red River with John Wayne, that her career probably would have been huge. But at all,
was Red River a Howard Hawks film as well?
Yes, it was.
I think it was. Yes, yeah.
And the interesting thing is John Wayne and James Arnett were very, very good friends, and when they were making Gunsmoke. They asked John Wayne who would be best suited, and he mentioned his best friend, James Arnaz. And that's how James Arnaz also got cast in The Thing, is through John Wayne and the Howard Hawks thing. Though I did do a little bit of research on James Arnaz, and I didn't actually realize he was the brother of Peter Graves from Mission Impossible.
I didn't know that.
Well, looking at the two of them, I can now see it, but I would have never known at the time.
Both huge men for their time. Mm.
And I remember for Gunsmoke, for me personally, I mean, growing up, Gunsmoke was a very big show in our household. And then I was born in 1965. It was on at that time. And when I was 2 years old in 1967, I got a dog and I named my dog Festus. So Gunsmoke was a big thing for me. And I had that dog until I was 18 years old. And he finally passed away, poor Festus. But yeah, Gunsmoke was a huge thing. And I think it's important to know that James Arnaz is known as the Greta Garbo of television. And the reason why that is that he would do his show, Gunsmoke, or do whatever he did as far as acting goes. But he wanted to be left alone. He was very camera shy. He didn't want the media to know anything about him. And he wanted to be just left alone. But when he was acting, he was fantastic. He was there on set. And everyone loved him. Everyone who's ever worked with him loved him. But when the cameras weren't on, he went right back to his world and lived his life, sort of thing.
He doesn't get to do too much acting in The Thing from Another World, but he definitely has presence. You know, there's that scene towards the end where he throws open the door, right? And they throw the gasoline on him. Where he really, his presence is enormous, not just in size, but in scope, you know. He doesn't have any lines or any, or really any sort of expressions or, you know, emotive moments. But he brings something to that role. He definitely does.
So, Nick, what's your thoughts about the actual film itself?
I love it. I hadn't seen it probably in about 10 years, and this was a wonderful excuse to revisit it. Like I was mentioning before, just the work, the sort of screwball attitude to the dialogue, characterizations. I love it. It's really enjoyable. I have no critiques of it the way I did of The Story Who Goes There. I think it is, for what it is, a perfect film.
And what about yourself, Stephen? What about your overall thoughts, the thing from another world, another planet?
You know, so on the one hand, I really like it. I do worry that on a certain level, if you put him in undersized, torn up clothes, he's Frankenstein. If you wrap him in bandages, he's mummy.
That's very true.
But other than that, they caught the setting well. They used thermite as the so at least one word made it all the way onto the screen.
you're right. I mean, the creature is very, very different from what Campbell wrote, and I had the same thought that you could take it's sort of a run of the mill monster story where the creature could just as easily be Frankenstein's monster without changing much. But yeah, they do have certain things. Like they have the scene where the severed hand begins to sort of come alive again. And that was reminiscent of the powers, I think, that Campbell gave his original alien. And also the scene with the seedlings that are growing. So they're sort of reminiscent. But yeah, it's definitely a lesser realization of the creature that Campbell came up with.
I mean, this is the first time I've actually seen this film, actually. It's one of those films I've always went to got around to actually seeing. And we had this monster movie matinee and back home that used to play on Saturdays I used to watch with my grandmother. But for some reason, The Thing from Another Planet never actually made it for my viewing. So it's one of those films I've never actually seen. Though, if you're a John Carpenter fan, you would actually see it like in the beginning of, Halloween, is what the kids are watching.
Yes,
and,
and
the title sequence you always see. I think even Rob Zombie even did it in his version of Halloween, God forbid. But it was, one of those films that I've actually seen. But actually sat down and actually go, okay, covering this, I'm going to watch it. I actually loved it. And I hate to say it, but, I know that there's, this is not going to be a popular choice, but I actually enjoyed this more than John Carpenter's The Thing to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And I know that's going to be sacrilegious to a lot of people.
It's a very different movie, though.
But you make a great point, though. And the point I think that's so salient about it is that John Carpenter's movie, as well done as it is, doesn't stand up well to the test of time. Whereas The Thing from Outer Space, it's a fragment or a relic from its time period, and it holds up brilliantly to the test of time.
I think that, I think the only problem that we have with The Thing from Another Planet, that unfortunately, because when the film came out in, 1951, we were in the hype of, don't trust science fiction horror films that we have coming out at that point. And the science is always going to go wrong. I think. And then we also got the end of the Universal Monsters making an end. They're about to make make a new appearance coming through, like the Dracula and The Mummy, and all those films are going to be reissued soon. And so we got the whole monster movie. And I think that The Thing gets caught up in having to make sure it ticks these boxes sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that, with James Arnaz as the monster, I have to say that I was quite shocked with his brutality of killing the dog. I wasn't expecting that. It's like,
that's a brutal scene.
Doing Jason Voorhees into the scratching the dog into a snowbank sort of thing.
I found myself hoping the dog act was okay.
Mm-hmm. it is a good step up from the later, the Thing, the Blob, the green slime movies. It's a huge step up from things like that, or Godzilla.
Well, I think what this movie really has going for is got a really well-established cast. And this is what I loved about films in the 50s 60s, not so much after the 60s, but I guess the early, the mid 60s backwards, is that their use of cast of character actors. And these character actors, you can see whatever movie star you want, whether it's Marilyn Monroe or Betty Davis or Katharine Hepburn or Spencer Tracy, and they're great in their own way. But for me, it's always the character actors, because they know what to do with their lines. They know what little business they can do, and they know what they can do, and they're the ones that carry the film. And with this film, it's basically a cast of character actors, and they just, you know, every single one is strong. You know, even to the smallest lines that one of them will say, you know that character. Every single character is so well drawn out, and that's one of those character actors.
Yeah.
And that's what I really liked about this. And I also sort of say the script and the way that they canter with each other and the conversations that they have with each other are so well done.
Yeah.
You know, and I think...
I still have to give a shout out to the John Carpenter's cast as well, because I thought, like I say, Keith David, Kurt Russell, who's the oatmeal guy? I forget his name now. Little bald guy.
God,
I know who you mean. The diabetes spokesperson also.
As nice as he is on screen, he's actually supposed to be nasty in person.
Well, he plays... Oh, really? Oh, gosh. Yeah. But he plays Blair in the movie.
Yeah.
And the ending of Carpenter... Well, it's not the ending of Carpenter's film, but that scene is in it, where they go to Blair's cabin and they find him working on a vessel.
Yeah.
It's taken right out of the story, and it's realized so well. Wilford Brimley.
Yes.
Wilford Brimley, yeah.
Wilford Brimley.
Like I said, all you have to say is oatmeal and everyone knows who you are.
Yeah. I knew exactly who you're talking about. You know, the odd thing about who goes there being made into the screen presentations is that you got this film, The Thing from Another World, which is almost, and then you look at John Carpenter's The Thing and you think to yourself that, you know, that they're both the same story, but in fact they're it's kind of strange, because actually The Thing from Another World almost feels like a prequel to John Carpenter's The Thing. Because if you look at it, because in The Thing, basically, the thing comes to them. They don't have the exploration or something like that. Doesn't it come via with the dog? And then it comes to them.
Right.
Right. And here, you basically got the exploration of them finding the thing and then taking it here. And then you have the ambiguous ending that they, you know, okay, they might have killed the monster, but did they, sort of thing. And so if
it
you think...
It doesn't feel ambiguous in The Thing from Another World. I get the sense that the monster truly is destroyed.
Yeah, but I kind of think that, you know, if you're electrocuting, the reason why I found it a little bit ambiguous is because, and I don't know if I'm bleeding the short story into this film version, but I thought that if you electrocute something and it got the impression it's dead, but then it has living tissue after it's dead, electrocution is not going to really kill living tissue. If it's,
plus it's vegetable matter, so yeah, who even knows, right?
I mean, how many plants get electrocuted every day and they still live?
I don't know if there's ever been a study on that. But Carpenter's film does start with footage from the Norwegian base that is very reminiscent of what we see in The Thing from Another World, especially that scene where they're standing around the circumference of the saucer underground, which is also interesting, right? In the story, it's not a saucer. It's described actually as more submarine shaped, which is which I thought was a good coincidence actually because of our novel. But, in the movies, they changed it to that sort of classic flying saucer shape. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was interesting.
Well, I think in even this film, it was more of a, it looked more of a submarine type of thing, because you saw the fin, you know, that's where,
yes, that's true,
so yeah. You saw the fin coming out of the snow, and I guess it was more submarine shaped than that. I do find that, I do think that Thing from Another World, it'd be quite more interesting if they could have done the whole paranoia thing, because I think they could have done a really good job with that side of it, you know, since...
Shape shifting. There's no element is not there.
And if you think of that, they did the shape shifting. As far as from a budget view, it wouldn't have been that bad to do it from a budget point of view, at all. sort of thing.
But I think audiences were ready at that time.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to shut off their brains and enjoy a monster.
Yeah. I mean, we would later get, of course, what was mentioned before, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers would actually would do the same thing, sort of.
Yeah,
thing.
Very much so. But
very effectively.
But 10 years later.
Yeah. So, you know, so maybe it was a simple fact that maybe America wasn't ready. I mean, we are dealing with, like, we're just finished the war sort of thing as well. You know, we're getting over the pangs of the war. And the baby boomers starting to, you know, that's going to start developing about 5-6 years later in 1956, 57. That's going to start coming into play. So this is just before all that. So, you know, I'd be quite interested to see what this devil featured with in this time.
Yeah. Maybe the cat people.
Val Lewton. As a god.
Great movie.
Yeah.
So, but it's fun to see. Oh, sorry. What were you saying?
Oh, no. Carry on.
I was just going to say it's fun to see the evolution. You know, my favorite one to look at is you look at I Am Legend, first by Richard Matheson. Mm-hmm. They made the movie Last Man on Earth, which was pretty true to the book.
Yeah.
With Vincent Price.
Halfway through the first half, it was true. Then they made Omega Man, which was, they were also smoking some 1970s Clear Age. And then they made the Will Smith Night I Am Legend, and it was kind of halfway between the other two. And, yeah. And still really ignored what Richard Matheson was getting at to begin with. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting evolution.
It's kind of weird I find with Richard Matheson is that whether you have The Legend of Hell House or any movies that are made from any of his books, they always tend to not quite get there with him. But when you consider that when he wrote scripts for, whether it was Twilight Zone or Outer Limits and the other stuff that he wrote scripts for, they were spot on. But for some reason, he'll write a script for one of his movies and they never quite get it right. I never understood why that was with Richard Matheson.
I don't know, but those scripts he did for Roger Corman for the Edgar Allan Poe movies are spectacular.
Yeah.
They're among my favorites.
But those were his scripts as opposed to an adaptation.
Because, I mean, he did write the film adaptation for the Legend of Hill House. I mean, no, sorry, Hell House, The Legend of Hell House, sorry. He did write the script for that. And then when you read the book, which I kind of understand why they didn't put everything in the book into the film, because the book is quite sexually racy, actually. It's quite a sexual orgy full book sort of thing. And I remember reading it and being quite shocked by it. You know, I just wasn't expecting it because I'm a big Roddy McDowell fan. I've seen a lot of Roddy McDowell films. And Hell House is, because he's in it, it's one of my favorite films. So I just wasn't expecting that sort of thing. But reading the book and, you know, seeing the film, and which he did write the adaptation for his own story, and it, they still didn't get it right. And as you're saying with I Am Legend, he did write, you know, the script for, you know, The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price. He wrote that script, but they, you know, said before, starts out, da-da-da-da-da, and then doesn't quite hit it. Yeah. So, which is, you know, it's quite weird with Robert, Richard Matheson.
Yeah. Interesting writer, though. Fabulous writer.
Yeah, he's... You can really get in. If anyone, any of our listeners are out there, you know, just get the Robert Matheson's books of short stories, and that will keep you entertained for hours on end.
Wonderful.
Fantastic writer. Even his
and you have to admit, whether it's John Lithgow or William Shatner, he did write the best Twilight Zone.
That reminds me of it. I got Spotify and I've been downloading William Shatner albums and I'm quite enjoying them. Oh, okay.
Why would you do that to yourself?
Because what happened is he came out with an album called Has Been.
Yeah.
And he did it with Ben Folds and Amy Mann and people like that. And it's a really good album. And there's some good, he does touch some real resonance. But I thought to that, well, I'll just download the rest of, you know, what else is on there and put them on a playlist. So it's not like I just listen nonstop William Shatner, but he does kind of mix in with the other music that I'm listening to.
I see.
And I'm quite entertained by him. So William Shatner, I mean, he's gone down as being a god now. You know, it's quite, you know, you take someone who's like, you know, you got him in Twilight Zone, his career, and here is William Shatner sort of thing in Twilight Zone. And then he does, you know, of course, Captain Kirk, which is iconic in its own right. And then he becomes a caricature of himself. And he's actually turned that into a multi-million dollar bankruptcy, and I have to, my hat's off to him, sort of thing.
I got to spend the day with him once.
Really?
Yeah. They made a computer version of the game, of his book, his Tech War book, and so I got to spend the day with him while they were working on that.
And how was he as a human being?
Well, so the week before I saw him, I went to a different shoot and got to spend a little while with Walter Koenig. And I said to Walt Koenig, "I'm going to meet one of your other compadres next week." And he said, "Who?" And I said, "Walt." I said, "William Shatner." He goes, "I thought you sounded sarcastic." And I said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! You're the one who's supposed to like him." And he said, "No, I'm just the only one who hasn't written a book about it."
Oh my God.
So I thought William Shatner would be terrible, but he was lovely in the time I spent with him. My only comment would be that he was clearly one of those guys who has one of those calendars with the word of the day, and you're supposed to work the word into conversation 20 times a day. And so I forget what the word was, but it kept on coming up. But one of the things I really liked about him, so many of the actors make up things. They want to give you this image. The best example I can ever give you was actually from Yasmin Bleeth from Baywatch, who looked at me with these incredible eyes and said, "I love playing Mario on my Atari." And I didn't deserve to explain to her that actually Mario isn't his mascot. He doesn't play on Atari. Mm-hmm. But William Shatner, he said, "Hey, look, I wanted to see what video games and computer games are all about. So I hired my next door neighbor's son and he came over and I watched him play them." And I love that. The other really honest one was Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, who he did a game for Mac or for PC. And while I'm interviewing him, in the middle of the interview, he goes, "Is this game going to play on my Mac?" And I said, "No, it's PC." And he goes, "Damn, that's another computer just sitting around my house." I just thought,
I have a deep respect. I was given a book of his to review, which I did review, and it was about his lessons in life, sort of thing. I thought it was gonna be more about an autobiography sort of thing, but it's basically how he's gonna see death and how he's gonna live life to the fullest. That's what the book's basically about. So it wasn't actually an autobiography. It was interesting, but I was hoping for. I like more autobiographies than kind of like self-help books. I kind of read a self-help book and I always feel a bit cold afterwards. So I always think, okay, someone get this person a joint or let's move them. The 60s is really good to you. I'm happy for you, sort of thing. So I always have that.
I think when we love a property, whether it's Star Trek or The Thing or whatever, we want a glimpse backstage, right? We want to hear stories about what it was like to be on that or to work on it. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I think we're all sort of drawn to these celebrity autobiographies, right? Because when it gets down to it, we want gossip, right? We want to hear did you get in a fist fight with Walter Koenig or what have you? We're very nosy people, I think.
Yeah, it's like see how the other half lives. But then whenever I read an autobiography or biography or whatever, or hear any of these sort of things, I always kind of remember what John Irving said. And John Irving said that if he ever wrote an autobiography of himself, it's going to be so much fiction in it to make his life seem a lot more interesting. He goes, because no matter what you start to write, by the time you finish it, you're going to have to flourish it. Because it's not like telling, like you get the people that tell you stories about their life. And they're like, kind of going, "Oh no, they're coming. Let's move away." Because they don't have the foresight that they can actually edit themselves and make it a bit more interesting before they come out. And right. That's the thing with the biography, they can make it more interesting because it's in written format.
So, three words to say to that. Guilty as charged. Bring your party out in about 20 seconds.
Yeah, I'm not very good at giving little story parables about my life sort of thing. I'm kind of like sort of thing, because I'm the kind of person that sounds interesting in my head, but when it comes out of my mouth, it's just not that interesting.
I think that affects all of us. Yeah.
I mean, that's why I became a writer, is because I'm charismatic on paper.
Yeah. That's why I think that's probably the reason why I don't telephone anyone anymore. I'm more charismatic through texting.
I was going to say the same thing. I don't like to use the phone. I just like to email and text people.
Yeah.
I sound so much more intelligent.
Yes. Because you can stop and think about what you're actually typing. And you can actually reread what you actually done. It. Once yeah, you said it, it's kind of out there in the world.
You can't delete something that you've already said.
The thing with Another World, I mean, the screenplay was actually written by Charles Lederer. Who was on credit rewrites from with Howard Hawks and Ben Hatchett. But the funny thing about Howard Hawks is that I think even if he was, he produced it, apparently he used to go in and he, because he paid the paycheck, he was pretty much an on-site producer. So maybe that's where the whole Christian Nyby and Howard Hawks debate goes on. Because, I mean, if you look at Christian Nyby's whole credits here, he'd done a lot of great films. You know, The Big Sleep, that's his. Red River is his. He also did a lot of episodes for Gunsmoke and Wagon Train, which is quite interesting. You know, when you look at, you know, his body of work. You know, he did Adam 12, Lassie, The Big Sky, you know, $6 Million Man, Ironside, Kojak later on.
Wow.
He did the Kojak episode, the one that was banned for a number of years about the killer who killed those nurses. And I remember that when that was on, my mom wouldn't let me stay up and watch it. I had to go to bed because I had the viewer discretion, the only Kojak of that. So, I mean, he had quite a long, extensive career. You know, and I guess, you know, when it comes to A Thing from Another World, whether he directed it or not, it would seem funny that he did not, considering that if you look at his body of work and all the successes that he did have, that he wouldn't have directed it.
Maybe Hawks was just an overbearing producer who was on the set.
Well, it seems to be like that same story that we have with Toby Hopper and Steven Spielberg when it comes to Poltergeist.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine with Poltergeist, I mean, I don't have nothing to back this up, but when you hear the story, I imagine when it came to all the cute little family things, I think that was Spielberg. When it came to the meat of it, I think that was probably Toby Hopper. Yeah. You know, because, you know, Steven Spielberg is quite good with the whole family feely moment sort of thing and the whole family dynamics thing. And probably the only thing that he does it that he had to work with, he hadn't had to work with anything else, is that he actually has a whole family instead of just a fatherless family like he normally has and everything. But and I imagine the scary side of things, which, you know, outside of Jaws, he doesn't really, I guess he had that, but he's quite good with pacing and the feeling of dread, but I don't know if he'd be very good with the actual showing of the horror or that side of it. So maybe, you know, maybe that's how it works. And maybe this is the way this worked with Howard Hawks and Christian Nyby. Maybe it got to the point where Christian Nyby was very strong with this part of it, but yet Howard Hawks was a bit stronger in this side of it. And so he would pigeonhole him in there and, like, shoot a couple off scenes to help overset the whole story. So
the dialogue is very Howard Hawks.
Yeah.
In tone, at least. So it did have a hand in the film. I think he definitely was working on that dialogue.
Well, I mean, he did go in and rewrite the whole, he did rewrites of the original script by Charles Lederer, and Charles Lederer wrote the Maltese, you know, I think, didn't he write one of the scripts for the Maltese Falcon and things like that? Mm. So, you know, so I guess, you know, so if you look at Howard Hawks as an individual, you know, he's got these great people around him, but he's still rewriting what they're doing. So, you know, maybe that's it, but, you know, Howard Hawks is always going to be one of those people that he's always going to be larger than life, isn't he? You know, wasn't he one of those kind of directors that, you know, had the big megaphone and, you know, kind of dressed like the classic, you know, producer sort of thing and kind of walked around the set like that? So, you know,
so he has a legendary body of work, definitely.
Well, I mean, if Warner,
so my question,
yeah. I'm just going to say, if Warner Brothers cartoons does you as a character, then you know you're a big character.
Yeah. My question is, did Christian Nyby do the American, the Chris Carroll episode of the $6 Million Man? That'll decide how much credit I'll give him for the movie.
I don't know. It doesn't really say which $6 Million Man he did. It just said that he did do several episodes for them.
Did you ever see that one?
I don't remember.
You have to remind the story. I mean, I was a big $6 Million Man Bionic Woman fan.
Same.
Outside of the Bigfoot episodes. I wasn't quite keen on the Bigfoot episodes.
So. The Christmas episode was terrible. He was all three ghosts trying to convince this guy to be a good guy, and he's jumping from time to time with his bionic legs, and what a mess.
That doesn't sound good.
No.
Is it when they jumped the shark? Was it one of those jump the shark moments? It was like, oh, this is not coming back for another season. Let's just throw anything at it. Was $6 Million Man was one of those odd sequences where I think the Bionic Woman became more popular. The spinoff became more popular than the actual series, but I think that has a lot to do with Lindsay Wagner. I think she was very likable, and because she had a lot more. She had a lot of empathy. I mean, apparently she doesn't have a lot of empathy in real life, but in the show she had a lot of empathy, sort of thing.
I don't know if you remember this, but on The Bionic Woman, she had a bionic dog named Max, who would occasionally have flashbacks to the fire in which he was injured and became bionic and was like given bionic legs afterwards.
See, I think that
comes. I don't know why that stuck with me all the years. The bionic dog is where it's at for me.
See, I don't know if the bionic dog was ripped off from The Hills Have Eyes 2, because that the dog in The Hills Have Eyes 2 had flashbacks as well of meeting the Rogers family.
Dogs with flashbacks are the best.
Yeah. What wasn't one of Wes Craven's highlights either, unfortunately.
No.
Did you either of you guys ever see Servants in the Rainbow?
Yes, I love
it.
I
did.
Me too.
It made me read Ray Davis' book.
I saw it at the movie theaters when it first came out. I actually haven't seen it since. I would like to revisit
it.
It holds up to, again, that's one that holds up to time very well.
There's a lot of Wes Craven stuff that doesn't actually, I mean, I like Wes Craven a lot. I think he was a good forerunner, but there are some parts of his film category that doesn't really hold up. So I'll revisit The Serpent and the Rainbow. I mean, there's that one about the guy who comes back from the dead after being electrocuted. I can't remember that one.
Shocker.
It doesn't hold up very well.
No, neither does Deadly Friend. The young android woman.
Well, you know you got problems in your cast when you got Albert from Little House on the Prairie trying to play a lead. But even like Last House on the Left, it's like, I remember like seeing that and like, you know, grinding, you know, one of these grindy drive-in sort of things. And then kind of rewatching it, it's like going, I don't know. I always had problems with the hillbilly cops and that. You know, the hillbilly music and the cops and the comedy relief is like, was never quite sure why that fitted in there. But as far as like The Thing from Another World, I thought it was quite interesting that you have three films, as you were saying, with the Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. And I thought it was quite interesting that each of these three films, whether it's The Thing prequel, which is a questionable movie within its own rights, and I think there were some problems with that. And then, of course, John Carpenter's cult classic, which was a flop when it came out in 1982, but became a huge cult favorite now. And then this film, of course. And I thought it was quite weird that they had one short story that's basically about 50 pages long, and they were able to take so many different elements for each of these three films, but each film works in its own little staple. Well, the prequel. Two out of three ain't bad, as Meatloaf would say. But I thought it was quite interesting the way that they took something and they were able to still keep in the quite, you know, those 50 pages of who goes there is, you know, a strong story as we discussed earlier. But then they were able to take this and they make two quite strong films and a minor third. But these two strong films, and I thought that was quite amazing, really, thinking about it, that, you know, from this short story that has actually spawned off these, you know, this kind of a franchise sort of thing.
Because the ideas are so fertile and the setting is so unique. And dark in the story. It's actually the North Pole in The Thing from Another World, which I thought was also an interesting change. But this idea of the isolated Arctic base where there's basically no escape. There's nowhere to go. It's such a great setting. And then the idea of just this sort of alien intelligence taking its toll on them is also such a fertile idea. I'm not surprised there haven't been more movies.
Do you think they changed the location because at that part, Alaska just became part of the States? Do you think that's probably the reason why they changed it to Alaska time?
I think there was a lot of interest in Alaska because it had just become part of the States. And so they thought, yes. And I think also it was probably just easier for them to imagine Alaska or realize it on film than in Antarctica.
I think that Campbell does better in this case than Philip K. Dick. You know, you've got all these movies based on Philip K. Dick because he had these great ideas, but his stories were almost treatments rather than stories. You know, you read Total Recall, I think it's based on a 3 or 4 page story, maybe 10 pages. But the ideas are so good that they make fine movies. And in this case, John Carpenter, I think to his credit, doesn't just take the idea. He does take a few scenes from John Campbell and uses them.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the original was almost like a Philip K. Dick treatment.
I think with the John Carpenter thing, I think that, unfortunately, I think though, and it's when it first came out for its time, it was ahead of its time as far as special effects. But of course, the special effects kind of do let it down. But as far as his characters are concerned, I mean, his characters are very, very strong. And I think that's what keeps the thing going. I think it, because the thing is, if you got rid of the special effects and got rid of that side of it, just kept the main cast there doing the same thing, the film was, I think, still lives up to its promise.
Completely. Well, 1982 is really interesting, dude, though, because that's the same summer, I believe, or maybe off by a year, but I think it's the same summer that Blade Runner came out and failed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you had these really pretty far-seeing movies that came out very close to each other, at least. And they've become huge cult classics. They've both been remade or prequelized or sequelized. And yet during the time they came out, they were complete flops.
Yeah. And they're visionary. They're absolutely visionary films.
Absolutely.
I also probably think that in 1982, I think we were in the middle of the whole stalker craze as well. And maybe people wanted probably more of another Halloween than Carpenter doing something else outside the realm. And I guess the thing would not fit into the whole horror, what was going on in the horror market at that moment. And
yeah, you were getting Friday the 13th Part 2 or 3 in 1982.
Yeah. Well, precisely. And then the same thing is what happened to Blade Runner. With Blade Runner, they even tried to market it as a Star Wars type movie because people wanted Star Wars. They didn't want Blade Runner. And then they didn't want psychological horror. They wanted slashers and hackers and stalkers.
And, you know, and even the science fiction that we did have that was making it big with the Alien franchise, you know, Alien was 79, wasn't 79, 80. That's horror. I mean, that wasn't intelligent horror or intelligent science fiction. It wasn't like this could actually happen. This was, you know, sci-fi horror. And I think we go on to the Predator at that time sort of thing, which was also a big sex. So our sci-fi at that time was even stalk and slash kind of sci-fi coming in.
Science fiction was becoming much more violent and action-oriented at that time, and something that was as slow and thoughtful as Blade Runner just wasn't going to capture the audience.
And home video was starting to make an impact, so that created a problem as well. So I think, you know, people, I guess they probably, long films also weren't doing very well at that time. You know, people only wanted 90 minutes of the Cineplex. That's all they wanted. In and out, go watch a movie, leave. And anything more than, if you look at all the big blockbusters at that time, none of them are a bit longer than 90 minutes long. So
yeah,
that might have something to do with it as well. But I mean, like, but then, you know, look at it now, out of all those films that are big blockbusters, very few of them are watchable today. I mean, you know, but if you do look at Blade Runner and you do look at The Thing and other films of that ilk that did crash and burn at the box office, but are now called classics, they do stand the test of time.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to watch. Do. It's really hard to watch Arthur and other big blockbusters nowadays. It's like there's something.
I remember thinking that was, you know, movies like this will never be forgotten. And,
you know, but I mean, even like when you watch Tootsie, which was like, you know, one of those films that won Oscars and stuff like that around the same time. And, you know, it does, I mean, luckily there's enough in it to keep it going, but it does suffer to a lot of a sense where, you know, and I think that has to suffer because unfortunately they do look very 80s, where The Thing and, you know, Blade Runner and other films, they don't look 80s. They're quite timeless because they choose to. Well, Ridley Scott's very visual because of his advertising background. But, you know, I think it's because of that. Even like Escape from New York, I mean, that wasn't a huge success at its time either. You know, John Carpenter was kind of, you know, making films. He'd become making himself a name. And I think, you know, he was able to keep to test the time because of that sort of thing. You know, where a lot of his contemporaries who were the big blockbusters at the moment didn't really last around that long. You know, they don't have the, you know, the clout or the following that he does today. So,
So I mentioned earlier that there is another adaptation of Who Goes There.
Uh-huh.
A fourth, I guess, lesser known and very loosely adapted from it. But it's in 1972. It was a Spanish and either British or American co-production. It was called Horror Express. And it starred Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. And it was basically intelligence body hopping through the passengers on a Trans-Siberian train. It's kind of like The Thing on board the Orient Express. And Telly Savalas, going back to Kojak, plays a Russian police detective who boards the train in the last half hour and just eats the scenery. He owns this movie. He's chowing down on the scenery. And so it's a really interesting, it's nothing like the story, except that we have this alien taking over people's bodies, basically. The effects are terrible. The alien can kill people by having glowing red eyes. And it's just, it looks horrible. It looks terrible. But it's a very fun movie, and if you ever have a chance to see it, I would definitely check it out, especially in light of having read Who Goes There.
Well, I think Who Goes There has actually inspired quite a few little films. Faculty, which is what we're covering next month, will cover, you know, it's pretty much The Thing also. Invasion of the Body Snatchers as well, a little bit of that. Jason Goes to Hell. Wasn't it Jason like passing from body to body?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Good memory.
kind of a Jason Voorhees fan. I think that's my creeping up on me, trying to keep me youthful, stealing from the stress. But yeah, I mean, I think like even the X-Files did one an episode as well where they had to do the whole testing thing that Who Goes There uses. Remember the electricity into the blood? And the X-Files use that in one of their episodes called Ice as well. So I think Who Goes There is, you know, it's one of those influences that, you know, I said before, more people probably should read it because it has influenced so much into our media and so much into our cultural studies. That whole simple thing about in the paranoia thing. And, you know, said before, he kind of foreshadowed the whole McCarthy era, you know. It's like, you know, maybe he's an Nostradamus writer, his own right sort of thing.
Well, if it was 1938, he was probably seeing what was going on in Germany and Europe. And there was unfortunately some American support for the Nazis in Germany at the time, and maybe that was his inspiration. Like, who among the people that I know harbor these secret thoughts?
Actually, talking about John Campbell a little bit, I was doing some research about him. Apparently, that he was a lot for human rights and stuff like this, but he had a peculiar way of doing this to spark debate. He would say really racist things to get people to get really upset with him before he would attack the issue. And so
he was an internet troll before there was the internet.
Kind of, but unfortunately what it has is that the people who knew him said that he was not racist, but the people who didn't know him and know about these little parables that he used to do thinks he's a racist. So it's, but all the money that he made actually went into like, you know, to like foundations to help you know, human rights and stuff like this. So it's quite interesting. But when you start, when I did a little bit of research on him, there's people, you know, blacklisting him and other people like praising him for the same thing. But it's kind of like, but the different sides of the coin. But then as I did a little bit more research, is that he was very much about human rights and stuff like this. So saying the thing about World War II and stuff like that makes it quite interesting as well with his version of who goes there.
Yeah.
And that's it there to say that, you know, it does put an interesting spin on it considering that time, because as I said before, it's written in 1938, but for some reason, World War II didn't even enter my mind. For some reason, I always think 1942 for some reason, and that was the end of it, wasn't it? So
I think that's when we got involved in it.
Well, that's when we got involved.
The
December 7th, 1941 was the attack on Pearl Harbor. So yeah. After that was when we got really involved.
Mm-hmm. So, but I guess, but all this stuff, the Germany was breaking down at that time, wasn't it, about 1938, so. But, so do we have any final thoughts about Who Goes There or The Thing from Another Planet? Stephen, do you want to start?
Just like, as you say, it holds a place in history. I think in the evolution, if we look back at the evolution of especially the junction between science fiction and horror, it holds a very prominent place.
And what about yourself, Nicholas?
I agree, definitely. I have a very strong love for Carpenter's film, the 1982 version that he did, as well as for Hawks's 1951 film. And they're so different. If you were to watch them in a double feature, you would barely see the DNA that they share. But that DNA is so strong, right? I mean, the ideas that Campbell came up with are so timeless and so fertile, as I said before, I'm really happy that I had this opportunity to read the story again and see that movie again and discuss it with you guys.
And my personally, I think it's one of those things that if you're going to be a lover of the genre, and I think it's important to know where that genre started from and to experience it, and no better way to start with the short story Who Goes There and, you know, The Thing from Another Planet, because, you know, we wouldn't have what we have today as far as horror or science fiction without these beginnings. And I think it's very strong, and both things are very strong. And I think they do say something about society, and the lessons that are learned from both are pretty much what you have today. You know, whether it's, you know, social media about who, you know, who are these people, letting these people into your lives sort of thing. And, you know, are people who are, they say that they represent themselves to be. And, you know, and I figured that the story does kind of address that in a science fiction sort of way. And I love The Thing from Another Planet. It's one of my new favorite black and white films now after experiencing this. So I highly recommend.
It's really charming. It's very charming. It's a very charming movie.
Well, I even like the sexism of it. You know, there's like that, just the sexism with Margaret Sheridan when the guy first comes up to her at her desk and, you know, he says something to her, but she doesn't shy away from it. She gives as good as it gets. So, well, you had like more arms than octopus, you know, and she just went on to it. I was like, this is a strong woman, you know what I mean? And it was really quite good. Though I did have one query. There's this other woman that had a long blonde ponytail, and she disappears. So I don't know what happened to her. I don't know if the thing ate her or what happened to her, but she kind of disappears. But
her name is Mrs. Chapman, and she's the doctor at the base.
Yeah, but what happened to her? She disappears.
She didn't get to do much, I guess.
Yeah, I figured maybe the monster ran off with her to do the sequel, The Thing from Another Planet 2, the deer, the baby. So what we're going to do is we're going to now close our thing. So before we close, so Stephen, where can people find you on social media or want to keep in touch with you?
You know what? I'm pretty much a ghost. Nick and I are very opposite here. I have a page called Sad Sam's Palace. I go to it once every year or two. And that's about it for me on the internet. So, you know, I hope you'll find me on Amazon and look at my books. But we're talking about evolution and, you know, how things have really evolved to this online thing. And I'm just the Neanderthal man looking at these new hairless apes and saying they'll never survive. They don't have enough hair to last the winter.
Well, hopefully your forehead will one day recede back into modern man's forehead.
If I hit it with the rock enough, it happens sooner or later.
And what about yourself, Nick? Where can people find you?
I'm on Facebook, Nicholas Kaufman. I have a website, nicholaskaufman.com.
Where you don't get how many N's left?
Oh, there are two N's. Thank you, Steve. There are two N's in Kaufman. If you go to nicholaskaufman.com and only put one N at the end of Kaufman, I don't know what you'll find. But remember, there are two N's. So yes, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. All the variations of Nick and Nicholas Kaufman were taken on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is The Kaufman. I don't know. It's just the way it worked out. And I'm also on Instagram now, but it's basically the same as Facebook. So, but mostly, yeah, check out nicholaskaufman.com with two N's at the end, Kaufman. You can find out a lot that's going out there.
So what we're going to do is going to bid adieu. Just to remind you, if you want to look up anything about the Literary License Podcast, you can find us at www.llpodcast.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, all under LL Podcast. Next month, we're going to be covering the John Carpenter's classic, the 1982 The Thing, and the Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Williams, other film, The Faculty. Some consider it a classic. Some of the people hate it, so we'll discuss that in full detail. Just to remember that if you are hanging around people and you don't know who they really are, just remember that maybe they are the thing from another world or another planet. You never know. So make sure these log into our newsletter, come onto our website, again at www.llpodcast.com. If you join up to our website, you can win a season one t-shirt, which has all Shirley Jackson, Cornelius from Planet of the Apes, and all the characters that we discussed in season one. So I'd like to say good night to you all, and we'll talk to you next week. Good night.
Holy cat. Hey. It's almost...
Yeah. Almost a perfect...
It is. It's round.
We finally got one.
We found a flying saucer.
Can anybody see anything through the ice from where you are?
Only an outline.
Nothing but a dark shape there. Seems perfectly smooth. No doors or windows.
Can't see any engine. I doubt if we find anything we call an engine.
Dr. Carrington.
This isn't any metal item. Probably some new alloy. Get some trialing or analysis.
Right.
Yes, it came from outer space to fill the world with terror, to bring you unforgettable suspense. What was it? Where did it come from? Who were the all-powerful creatures it brought from outer space? And what did they want on Earth?
From outer space.
friend. Look, I have no weapons. I'm your friend. You're wiser than I. You must understand what I'm trying to tell you. Don't worry, Father. They'll kill you. They think you mean to harm us all. But I want to know, to help you. Believe that. You're wiser than anything on earth. Use that intelligence. Look at me and know what I'm trying to tell you. I'm not your enemy. I'm a scientist. I'm a scientist.
Giving you the details of the battle, I bring you a warning. Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, tell this to everybody wherever they are. Watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.